people get involved with Puna and as a community, I think. I think we have a community view that Puna is our community.
Okay, thank you.
So what we were going to try and do is, before my laptop decided to lock up and lost all my work, I had a list of
power of
bloody Ubuntu, that's what it is. Dapper works good. Just tell your boss Dapper works good. Have another one of those. Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, well, I've got a red hat then. She said, yeah. So, what we were going to do is, either if people have things, the idea is to try and teach people to get involved with GNOME as a community in some way. So, a lot of people who promised to be here aren't. Yeah, tell me about it. So, the idea was, if there was anything people want to get involved with, they could form smaller, free-form groups. And then don't do that. Yeah. That's probably okay. But then, we could also, so people form free-form groups, learn how to hack code, or how to get involved, how to fix a bug. What you guys wanted to do, like, it wasn't going to be someone standing down the front, just talking to you about this technology or that technology, or even the how do you get involved talk, because to be honest, that was really dull. So does anyone have any ideas to start with?
I've got a question. A while ago, when I was using XFCE, I had a battery monitor that would actually stretch the panel at the bottom, like it would make it bigger.
In XFCE?
In XFCE, so not, it was in the case though.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's directly relevant. But every time the battery monitor was in the panel above, it wouldn't shrink below a certain size for some reason. So I'm not sure if that's directly relevant or not.
Now I've been kind of lost me for coffee, so we can chat about it. Yeah, can you have another thing? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You have all the ideas, your ideas. Then what? So what? We're just talking about, this is the GNOME thing. No, about that. You think it'll work, Martin? That's a good question.
We don't have whiteboard.
Oh, you're going to need chalk then?
Chalk?
What kind
in this modern age.
Yeah, we could do that as well. Let's just jack in. Let me just minimize my email and my telepathy as well. A bit special. What happened there? It's a work in progress. That's not good. That's we managed to mess up my Excel. The weird thing is it's only the Oh, that's bizarre.
Oh, you're on.
Not fine, dude. No.
I love it.
I knew pre-lighting was good for me. Oh, what the hell?
And she's under the chart.
You see the way these icons fade in now?
Okay.
So, teaching people to get in, like, helping people get involved. So, we'll get some ideas down and we'll form small groups. I'm actually going to set myself offline before someone messages me. So, does anyone want to start this off? No, that's good. Yes, exactly. Here. So, the idea here is that, like, we want to help you get involved so you can write these kind of passages. So, we can add that in.
What might be broken in genome, or what they'd like to see differently, or you know, simple things like that. Maybe if you're on the network, you can sort of bring up the list of genome love bugs as well. One other thing you could do is actually split up into groups now, and then each group identify one part of the desktop that they might like to fix and write.
People can do that if they want. Network manager? Do you just want to write the word network manager on there? Because that will be a bit dull. There's a lot of reasons for that, but I don't know what they are. No, I've never got one called that. Is David Zukin here? No, he's meant to be. That's a shame. anything else? Come on, guys. Is that, I'm just going to get Das to help me pull telepathy. Okay, good. No, this is just, the idea here is that, like, you guys want to help get started in GNOME, like, learn how to hack code, or learn how to be part of the community. So we're trying to get some ideas up so we can then split into smaller groups and actually work on some of these ideas. So we're just trying to get some ideas down so people can say, yes, I'd like to work on that, or I'd like to learn more about that. And it's more of a box than anything else. That's technically Thursday, but if some people want to see some stuff, then I'm more than happy to show them some stuff, and they can turn up to the talk on Thursday as well. You reckon? Well, that's his audience. Yeah, that's really sad.
I just talk
about... we're talking about extending desk bar. That's actually quite a lot of fun. Hey, Dan, do you want to talk about telepathy for a second?
Telepathy is not really NEM-specific, but the idea is that you have a unified interface which you can use for the various text, audio, video messaging systems that are available. So stuff like Jabber, MSN, IRC. You have a unified interface which you can use for doing whatever you want with them. and this is used on the Nokia 770 and 800 for their text messaging and audio video stuff. And some people are working on making Gossip, which is a IM client for GNOME, be able to use telepathy for sending messages, which means that Gossip can do, in addition to Jabber, it can start doing stuff like MSN and...
I want the Rendezvous stuff.
Yeah, it can do, also do link local messaging, which means that basically you can see all the people who are around you using Avahi, and you can start conversations with them like you can in-game. And there's also some work on doing what's link local chat groups, so you can see local like IRC channels on the local network, which you can sort of browse and join. And heckle, because you could be on your laptop.
Without needing IRC, yeah. okay, so if people want to learn about telepathy, then would you be happy to show them more?
I haven't actually got it running on my laptop.
I'm sure you get it running.
Is that sorry? Yeah, it does video chat. I could demo it, but my battery on my NS100 is flat. The MSN video chat isn't completely reverse engineered yet, but there's some people working on it.
Yep.
I think it's just general ideas about things to talk about.
Yes.
I've got one.
Yes, Jana.
I think it'd be interesting to talk about how applications are designed. A lot of this is very technical stuff, very developer focused, but the usability and how we can design applications before writing them.
Yeah, we can talk about that. We could start with that if you like, unless anyone else wants to add anything else at this point. To Jono. Jono, you want to start? Well, you brought it up.
Okay.
If you like.
Right, okay. I didn't actually expect to have to talk about this. I was hoping you would.
Well, I'm happy to, but...
Okay, the reason why I said this is that there's a few different approaches to application design, I'd say, in the GNOME world, well, and the KDE world as well. Some people think this would be a good idea, and they hack some code. And they kind of they hack some code, and then the usability side of things comes afterwards. And you know, we have a saying in England that you can't polish a turd. And that you engage in a rigorous session of turd polishing when you take that approach. Whereas to me, the better way of doing things is to think of the usability, think of the application design first, and then write the code afterwards. Which is, you know, the so-called right way of doing things. But it often doesn't feel very natural to do loads of mock-ups and then blog about them and all the rest of it. So I'm interested in people's ideas about how we go about making better usable applications. Anything? Any initial thoughts? Read the Higg. The Higg's one good thing. For those who don't know what that is, Human Interface Guidelines, Open Usability. Yeah, I mean, to me, usability falls into a few, like, usability is kind of a kitchen sink for a lot of different terms. You know, people use the word usability when it comes to architecture, when it comes to product design, when it comes to product visualization and things like that. And it's a kitchen sink term. What we're actually talking about is good design. Good design is what we want. We want to make design that fits the kind of things that we think about. I mean, a good example of this is something that Seth Nickel brought up. Would you stop sneezing? Very distracted. Something that Seth Nickel brought up a couple of Guadex ago was one of the best designed products in the world is the condom. Because the condom is pretty intuitive. It's fairly discoverable. You know, it's a pretty simple device. It's cheap to manufacture, and it's pretty reliable.
Nobody wants to get it wrong.
The problem at geek conferences is that most people have never used a condom before. So,
I want to play volleyball with one.
That's a bad thing. Yeah, so the condom is a good example because it's extremely simple to use. Again, it's reliable, it's cheap. And that's the kind of thing we need to do with, I think we need to do with GNOME. We spend a lot of time looking at the periphery, you know, and we need to always ask questions of our desktops, you know. Can the computer figure this thing out for me? I mean, a good example of this is I tried to get some traveler's checks to come over here. And when I was doing that, I was trying to sort some traveler's checks out, and I went to my online bank, HSBC, and typed in the details of my account details, my credit card details, and then it said to me, which bank are you with? And the thing could figure that thing out for me. You know, it didn't need to ask me that question. It was just one other thing that I could get wrong. And it asked loads of nonsensical questions and went through these steps and steps and steps and processes that were completely irrelevant. It's exactly the same problem with small print. You know, when you sign a contract, you get all the small print coming through. It's completely irrelevant to, I'm not going to read it. You know, then the people who make these things need to have an understanding that most people don't read small print. So therefore, if we don't read small print, therefore we're not going to read that stuff, and therefore we're going to get bitten in the ass. The thing is that in those situations, the small print is there to cover their back. And I think a lot of that happens with application design, is that people do things because it basically covers their back, instead of actually thinking about where users are going to be doing these and those things. Any other thoughts on usability? Yeah, exactly that. I used to be part of the KD project. Not any longer. I left the KD project because, to me, it turned into an aeroplane cockpit. I mean, I'll give you an example. This is one I've brought out at conferences before, which was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. One night I was on IRC, I was talking to this guy called Rick Helmsley. And Rick and I were talking about, I had this idea to put a little thing down the side of the K menu. With that, it served a few purposes. Distros could brand KDE, and those distros that did brand it, or just left KDE as it was, could put the version number in there, which helped with support. So we had, because a lot of people had no idea which version of KDE they were using. So he thought, yeah, this is a good idea. He wrote a patch, committed it to CVS. I went to bed that night, happy boy. Got up the following day, someone had written an email to the developer mailing list saying, okay, I saw this patch that had gone in for this thing down the side of the menu. I've written a button that goes in the control center to turn it off. And it's like, for fuck's sake, you know, we don't need that in the control center. We don't need everything to be switched off. We need to make decisions on behalf of our users. And the problem that happened there was that the KD project was not making a decision about what our users actually really will need to switch on and switch off. And with GNOME, we've made a lot of decisions which have meant a lot of users have come over to the project because we've said this is where we're drawing the line, and the KD project haven't necessarily drawn the line, and they've lost some users. Some would say that we're being a little bit too restrictive, you know. But figuring out our user base and our use case. So, any other thoughts, opinions? Feel free to tell me I'm smoking on the crack pipe. I think mockups serve a purpose, but are not the only way of doing things. Because, I mean, I'm so tempted to pimp my talk tomorrow, but well, I've done it now. Tomorrow morning in here, Jakosha talk, where we mocked up the application interface before we wrote the application.
You think you know what you've got to do in your head,
yep.
But unless you actually write it down and mock it out or whatever, you realise that actually all this stuff that's been clear in your head,
yeah.
You haven't actually got the first clue what the answer to all the questions is.
Yeah.
And writing it down forces you to actually think about all these cases that you've got to write out.
Exactly. And the thing is, I think when you're doing mockups, when you're doing application design, you always need to... Jesus. When you're doing mockups in application design, it shouldn't be something that you do by yourself. I don't think mockups are a good thing for one person to do. You need to sit in the room with somebody else who appreciates or is interested in usability and have them question the things that you're talking about. So sit there with a beer mat and flesh out various ideas and question every little essence of that application. So if you're writing, for example, if you're writing a text editor, not that the world needs another text editor, but if you're writing a text editor, one of the first things I'd ask is, why do we need to constantly have to save things? Why doesn't it save things automatically for us? You know, but then that brings up other issues, like if you have continuous save, a lot of people use saves as milestones in a project, so they may save this particular document when they're completely writing this amount of a section. So then that brings up various other issues, and then you think, okay, so we need to think about continuous save, but we also need to think about milestones in that save. And this is something we have with Jacocha as well. Jacocha, at some point, you will not need to save, it will be continuous save. Because saving is, the amount of time people lose projects means that it's something worthy to strive for. Yeah, exactly. No, I completely agree. I mean, there's lots of different things. I mean, continuous save is something that we've put off until later because it's a big problem. And it's also a lot of usability people bang on about. A lot of usability kind of people churn out the same old examples like the nipple is the most intuitive user interface. You know, because we all started out with that when we were younger. And a lot of this is bull. A lot of usability people make claims that most people don't actually buy into. Like the whole, you shouldn't put the shutdown option in the start menu. It's all very well saying that in pure usability kind of discussion, putting shutdown in the start menu doesn't make any sense. But 90% of the world are used to that. So therefore, we've got to accept that most of the users, that's the way things work. What are you looking for?
I was trying to find your mock-up, but the internet hates me.
Yeah.
It's not connected at the moment, Jenna.
Sorry, say that again. Right, okay. So you're talking about turd polishing now.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, I need to clarify that I don't think all the programs we've got are turds, first of all. The question was, how do we fix existing applications? And it is difficult. But I think the first step we need to do with any application is question every decision that's been made in that application. And question the kind of people who are supposed to use it. So, again, using text editors as an example, I wouldn't ask the same questions to Emacs that I'd ask to gedit, because they're designed for two different groups of people. And I wouldn't ask the same questions, you know, for Abbey Word. But I don't think you necessarily always have to mock something up. I think mock-ups are good for brand new applications that are defining a different and new sense of direction. And they give other people something to look at. Like, for example, with Jacocha, the fact that we had some mock-ups meant that anyone who joined the project, they already had a sense of the direction that they were going in. Because we were doing something different. I mean, again, if you were doing something like a text editor, then there's a certain norm there that it's easy to kind of cover. Whereas because with Jacocha, it was a radically different way of doing things. A lot of people wanted to help the project, but they didn't really know what that direction was. So having the mock-ups there meant that they had something that they could cling on to.
Jono, did you want to pop those mock-ups in?
Let me try and find them. Yeah. No, I completely agree. It's not easy. Right, let me just try.
And then what you see about there is no usability, so that's all usability engineers, they start shutting down the computer.
know what it is. Sorry, say that last point again.
But there is no absolute usability.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah. I say so. It's tempting to say, it's tempting for people to say, to get on their high horse and state usability facts. But at the end of the day, one of the things we need to take into account is learnability, and learnability is the fact that most people in the world know how certain things work. There's a brilliant book by a guy called Donald Norman, who called The Design of Everyday Things, and I think everyone in this room should read it.
Has anyone here read it?
It's brilliant.
Has anyone here else read it?
The guy has a go at doors. He says that doors are unusable. And you think, a door? All you have to figure out is how to open it and which side it is, but he has a go at doors and how these different configurations of doors don't work very well. And then he talks about, different decisions and how they've been made in different ways. I'm not going to go into too much into this because this is for tomorrow. So yeah, so that was the initial mock-up of Jacosha. Hang on a second. Let me go back.
Try the other tab.
This one. Okay. I wrote this blog entry. I had a load of grief, but I'm part of a podcast called Log Radio, and we record it in Windows. I had a load of grief because we recorded it in Windows. I sat down with a friend of mine and we designed Jacosha, and questioned everything. Like, for example, tracks are a concept in audio editors. People add tracks and things sit on those tracks, whereas in Jacosha we have instruments, because what the hell does the word track mean? Most people think of instruments. That's what people are interested in. And little things like these big buttons at the top, see where it says number one. When I'm recording in my studio, I'm usually stood there with a guitar around me, and I'm stood up, and I've got the mouse in front of me, and I can't click on tiny little buttons. I need a big button to click on, because I'm stood up and my hand's bent. And it's tiny little examples like that which help you design it. Putting very few transport buttons up there. We've had a big debate recently about whether we should have a play and a pause button. And because it's in contravention with the known HIG. There's no overlapping windows, because overlapping windows are just a pain. There's loads of examples. I mean, I'm going to give a bunch of them tomorrow morning. But that was the main interface, and then the idea of instruments. So again, you add an instrument to a project. So you create a project, you want to record your guitar playing, you add a guitar to it. And one of the benefits of that is that with tracks, so for example, I use Cubase, which is a Windows and Mac-based audio editor. When I use Cubase, if I want to add an effect or a preset of effect to my instrument, then it lists all of them. It lists all the vocals, drums, bass, everything. But because when you add an electric guitar to a Jacosha project, we know what that is. Therefore, we only need to display the electric guitar one, so we can put less things in front of the user for them to trip up. Creating instruments is simple. We're going to provide an interface to this, but creating instruments is just a text file and an icon. At the moment, instruments are basically just a unique ID of what it is that you're doing. But in future versions of Jacosha, because we've already got that there, we know the kind of information that's going to be sat on that track. So for example, the big plan is that not for 1.0, but for 1.1, is that when you open up Jacosha, you'll be able to add a certain project. So you'll be able to you'll be able to select whether I want to record a metal song or an indie song, or whether I want to record a podcast. So if I want to record a metal song, which is much of the stuff that happens in my studio, then it will add two guitars, a bass guitar, and a drum kit. But for the guitars, it will select a preset that's particularly good for distorted metal guitars. If I want to record an acoustic song, it will probably add a guitar, an acoustic guitar, maybe a bass and a vocal, and it will set up the acoustic guitar with a default that sounds good.
So that means that we can automatically figure out the kind of stuff. You know, we know the kind of music they want to create. We know the instruments that are on there. So therefore, we can make a lot of these decisions already. We're already, you know, questioning, saying, why the hell should they have to go in there and set these things up, you know, themselves? You know, so really approaching it from that thing. There's a guy at the back with his hand up. Yep. Right, so the question is, why not improve one of the existing audio editors? The original plan was to improve Ardour. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about Ardour it wouldn't be about me improving Ardour, it would be about me taking away their direction. Because Ardour is really designed for sound engineers, designed for people who know about sound engineering. Yeah. Yes. I don't think so. Because I think, if put it this way, if we were doing the same thing with Audacity, maybe, then yes.
Can I add something here? What you bring up an interesting point, like, is it the weakness of what we do that every man and his dog and Jono can go and fork a piece of software and create their own piece of software and bring out their own ideal? At the same time as being a weakness, it is a strength. You've got the thing, because Jono has all the source code and he can create his own idea, that idea gets created. If in a world where that didn't take place, Jono could have his idea and say, I've got this brilliant idea, and that's it. We'd never see the idea, and in the end, the ideas wouldn't compete. Yep. So you have one idea, it would stagnate, it would never evolve. And with no competition, there's no selection.
Yes. I mean, I think that you need to look at the kind of projects that you want to improve to see whether it fits within the scope of that project. I mean, like I said, with Ardour, my original plan was with Ardour was I contacted Paul Davis, who's the guy who predominantly works on Ardour, and said, you know, I'd like to help you with the usability side, even just dialogue design. I mean, the dialogue design in Ardour is just horrific. It's very kind of sanitary. It doesn't seem to have any kind of human interface guidelines or usability approach to it. But the kind of people who use Ardour are the kind of people who don't really, they're after the details, they're after the jargon, after the specifics, because they're engineers. The kind of people who use Ardour are the kind of people who use Pro Tools, they're the kind of people who work in studios. When I sit in front of my computer and I'm going to record something, I don't want to be confronted with technology. I'm interested in technology outside of that space. I don't want to be confronted with what I'm recording. I just want to press a big red flashing record button and start making music. And Jacosha, it was so different a direction to Ardour that, to me, it would have been negative for me to hammer them about usability because I'd be trying to take their direction away. I think if it's the same thing, I mean, like, for example, I can't imagine doing this for something like Rhythmbox. You know, Rhythmbox, most media players go to the same kind of people, maybe with the exception of things like Amarok and Xero. But if you're going for an easy-to-use media player, then I can't see why you'd necessarily want to create a whole new project unless it was so radically different. And thinking about Jacosha, Jacosha is quite a radically different UI design in many ways. So. Any other thoughts? Someone said that to me at Guadec, at the last Guadec. I did the demo. I've never seen GarageBand before, and there are some similarities. But honestly, none of the developers have seen GarageBand, so. Which, yeah, interesting. I can assure you that Jacosha does look better than this. This looks a bit ropey. But there'll be a demo tomorrow. Well, I'm hoping I'm going to have time for a demo tomorrow morning. I'm going to talk about the history of it and everything.
I was going to say, we'll just wait and pass over to Andrew. Another thing with what John brought up, designing the software here for musicians instead of sound engineers, when you're designing the software, it's very important to know who you're designing for and to work out what your target, who your target is. For example, if you're writing an instant messaging application, if you're writing gossip, then you need to have a roster and you need to have people, because the use case is, I want to find someone to have sex with. Because whether that may not be true here, it's certainly true when, you know, most of the young people I know use MSN, is they're just looking for someone to hook up with. But at the same time, when I'm writing software in a professional sense, I'm writing software for people with 20 years experience in a very narrow field. And the software is complex. If I gave that bit of software to anyone here, you'd all just look at it and you'd go, what's a fold? Because you've got to design these things. So usability, you can get tied down when it comes to usability, but if you don't know who you're designing for, then you can't design it. So if you know you're designing for a geophysicist, which is what I'm doing, writing software for geophysics, then you're making it usable for geophysicists. You're using stuff geophysicists understand. You're making it so it's intuitive for them, because they expect certain things. Whereas if I'm writing a text editor, or if I'm writing this, this is designed for musicians. So while people here who aren't musicians may not know what a distortion effect is, guitarists do. And so you design for that. You don't go, oh, it's an effect that makes it kind of gravelly sounding and really grungy and cool. You say it's a distortion effect. So I think it's important to realize when you're designing usable software to know what your target is. In the desktop, it happens that your target is the theoretical grandmother, which kind of makes me laugh a bit. I've been guilty of saying, I like this design because I think my mother would understand it, which is a terrible thing, because my mother has like 6 degrees or something. She's actually quite smart. But so on the desktop, you are designing for this theoretical, all-encompassing user. But often we haven't defined who that user is. And I know at one point, Glenn had a thing coming up when he was talking about, what do you call them? You got the people, the theoretical, hypothetical people? You had some people like, there's a sysadmin and a...
Profiles,
that's it. I don't really buy into usability design jargon. And you create these hypothetical people. So you might have a system administrator, and you might have my mum, and you might have my grandmother, and you might have a developer, and then you might have, you might have my brother, something like that. So you've got a range of people, and you work out what they know, what kind of things they're interested in doing, what tasks they want to complete, and you design the software to fit within those groups of people. So you look at the thing, you look at instant messenger, and go, does it allow my brother to hook up with cheap floozies on the internet? Yes, it does. I've met my design goals. Is it easy? Yes, it is. I've met my usability goals. Well, if the computer could write all the cheap one-liners for you, then you've definitely met the usability goals. But did you want to add something, Andrew?
Yeah, a couple things. I missed who it was back in the room who asked. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Monitors again. Somebody said, oh, they've already abandoned project on SourceForge. And I actually used that as one of the opening pieces of evidence at my keynote that popped out in this year about what I believe to be the fundamental structural problem in the open source movement. Actually, there's several. But the really big one is, in my mind, the difficulty in cooperation between projects. I'm not going to rant on about that at great length, other than to say that the most exciting thing going on in free software these days is that there are people working to break down the barriers between projects. And that is starting to allow, I mean, in the traditional sense, we all know about libraries and code reuse, but that's a technical thing. And open source is a social phenomenon. And so the biggest question for the hackers in the room is, what are you doing to make your software more approachable for other developers? This is the GNOME love session, and so a big subtext to that is, how do you bring new people into your project? Because if you don't find a way to bring other people up to speed to become committers, and then core maintainers, and eventually a project lead, then you're going to have to be that project lead forever and ever. And that's not going to happen, because you're going to get bored of it sooner or later. And unless you groom somebody to take over to pass the torch to, then your software dies. In which case, what the heck have you been doing for the last 3 years? And so one of the things this conversation really started with talked about prototyping. And you just saw Jonah's discussion of mock-ups. And that's really powerful. But I think one of the mistakes that people often make is they start with the UI and event-driven GUI programming is, of course, you can start putting buttons off and you can start being very dynamic.
But that's not really the best place architecturally for logic to go. And one of the things that people are so driven by, like, oh, I've got to have cool screenshots, I've got to have a big UI, so we spend all this time fussing about that. And yet, these are the same people that if you were to say the subject extreme programming or agile programming, they go, oh, yeah, sure, I understand about refactoring my code and stuff. Well, there's very much an architecture boundary between the internals of your system and the UI that presents it. And so if you've got a good, in the enterprise world, services boundary, whatever, if you've got one of the problems with user interfaces is that they're very difficult to test. And it's all the more reason to have a really solid internal core. And if you start building up solid libraries that get done the use cases you need to get done, then you can always fix the UI later. And an example of this going on right now that I think is somebody is doing in the right direction is Philip Van Hoof, who's the guy working on Tiny Mail or Tiny Mail, or whatever the hell he wants to call it.
Tiny Mail. Yeah, yeah. Tiny Mail. Sucker.
And so with Tiny Mail, he's been working really hard on a library to help make mail and applications that need to send and process and read mail more possible, and he's done like a little tiny crap user interface on top of that, so he can at least, you know, test his own APIs. And that's okay. It doesn't look flash and bling, but I know a lot of people are really excited about this work he's doing because finally we're going to have an email library that we can use, and then I think you're going to see over the next course of the next 18 months all kinds of new mail clients appear. Because unfortunately the evolution project, because it didn't have clear ways for people to get into it, has been an enormous tombstone in the ground where nobody can participate. And so for the people who are working on that project, what's the point? Nobody can get involved in it. And so in terms of getting involved in a project or writing your own software, I don't think there's anything wrong with starting your own project, but do pay lots of attention to how can I let other people get involved in that. And that's the biggest thing about any project to make it successful isn't the code you're writing, but the community that you encourage to grow around it.
I was just going to say, expanding that as well,
just to kind of back that point up, I think like the philosophy of the program needs to extend to the things around it. So for example, we've got some really easy to use applications, but it's incredibly difficult to submit a bug report. And one thing we ask of our users is that if something breaks, they tell us. And so that's something else that we need to kind of factor in, as well as building community around it, things like discussion forums and user documentation. I mean, you look at any forums, and like, for example, the Ubuntu forums, and there's loads and loads of impromptu guides about how to do stuff in Ubuntu. But they appear on a forum, and it's very difficult to find them there. So the idea of having easy-to-access websites around your project where they can build documentation, and we've done all of this with Jacoshi. There's a user-editable wiki where people can write guides, and people have started writing little guides about how to do stuff, how to make things happen, and that all helps the project grow and helps the kind of the community grow around it as well.
So you proposed the idea you're talking about is where you have a documentation system and you can append to it, or so on and so forth, Jono.
Sorry, say that again?
You're talking about having a documentation system where you've got formal documentation and then you've got user editable and commentable documentation, and you slowly see migration from the latter into the former.
That's what we're doing. But we've seen the user editable side of things actually take over.
Yeah. And then migrated over.
So we've merged that into the main documentation.
Yep.
Well,
libraries in OMOG is meant to theoretically solve that, I think, but we'll see if we ever actually see working code.
One thing I wanted to add for the usability talk we had before is that keep in mind that usability is not a fixed term. It moves and it changes a lot. One of the projects I've been working on over the last month is actually enabling multiple cursors in X, and I can tell you that pretty much all of GNOME's user interface guidelines just fly straight out of the window when you've got two mice to use in one application. GIMP suddenly is just, it's fancy what it does, but there's no guidelines anymore. Like, the application just goes rogue. So keep in mind that guidelines are always changing, and there's no fixed term of usability. You have to update it, you have to change your mindset all the time.
And
I was on the mailing list a while ago and wanting to add an eject someone wanted to add an eject button to the side pane of Nautilus or something like what Mac does, I think.
Oh, no, the one that's the places menu. The recent one, yeah.
Something like that. But in general, I see things like that shot down before the get-go because of for disabled people and for the accessibility guide and for things like that. And I just would want to know everyone's thoughts on will that become a handbrake on GNOME? At some point, you just say, well, this is the best that's going to be usable by an accessibility challenged person, and let's not hinder the rest of it for that case. And I'm not saying that an eject button was a good idea either. I'm just
speculating. So you've got an interesting point there. One of the problems you've got, I don't know if I quite get this right because I don't quite understand US government tender processes, but in order for the US government to purchase software, it has to comply to something in their thing called Section 501C. 508. Maybe 501C is from non-profit companies. You see them both so often. But what it means is that software has to be accessible by people who fit certain definitions of disabled. They might be blind or colorblind or have low contrast vision or have no arms. I have no idea exactly what the guidelines say. But if your software doesn't meet those requirements, then you can't sell it to the US government. And then by thing, a lot of other countries who mass import legislation from the first world, if it doesn't meet those requirements, you can't sell it to them either. And there's still a lot of things. Like, there's a lot of government uptake in GNOME. Particularly, you look at some of these. Name some countries for me. Spain. Oh yeah. Not Extremadura. Yeah, Extremadura. Brazil. China, perhaps. Venezuela. You know, I just wrote this for the annual report, and I can't remember what it is.
But I'm just wondering, is it an offensive thing to say, well, our accessible interface for this feature can be here, and here's a completely different interface which is more tweaked for more accessible people, and well, let's not just say no immediately because those two interfaces are different? Because I think I see that happening sometimes to shoot down new UI ideas.
I think. I think it's important that your software is accessible, but it doesn't need to necessarily be accessible in the same way. Like when you write your web browser, you've got to be able to get the information out of it. Because otherwise you're going to end up writing two web browsers. So you've got the thing. The problem with the eject button in the places menu, I just think it was a bad idea as well. If there's anyone who's ever going to put that, I'd put it in the sidebar of Nautilus, which someone has a patch for.
Yeah, I think I was thinking that they were talking about putting it in the sidebar Nautilus.
Yeah, I actually quite like that idea, but the reason that may actually be patented by Apple. Apple has a whole bunch of that stuff locked up. Spring folders and all those kinds of things. Pascal?
Yeah, where I see ideas shut down pretty often in terms of usability and design, this is happening a lot currently in KDE artwork and stuff.
Is simply because if someone comes along, this is happening right now where I'm actually shooting down ideas, is KDE artists are going, oh, well, you know, we are doing X, Y, Z, and then you ask them why they're doing it, and the justification is because OSX does it. And that's where I see a lot of ideas being shot down, and that's where I'm personally joining in, because if someone can't describe their design decision, then there's no point implementing it.
I think there's an important tenet there of the whole thing is, I hold this up all the time, is Mac OS X is not the be-all and end-all of user interface design. I actually have an excellent example of this, if you give me that. This is the Mac OS X connector server dialog. The only way to get it, as far as I know, in Mac OS X is to click on the desktop and press Apple K. Is there a menu item? Maybe they've added that.
Even if
It's confusing, isn't it? It pulls it out. Which is what everyone does. But this, I've been pushing this for the contendably worst dialogue in Mac OS X. Unfortunately, no one in Apple listens, so they haven't bothered to fix it yet, so I'm gonna. But you've got some great buttons. I love this plus one up here. Like, what does that do? Does anyone actually know what that does? Is that because you know Mac OS X? Yeah, I know what it does because I found out by clicking on it. But you look at it and you go, well, what does it do? Yep.
And the people who know a bit about usability are people going to use it.
That's true as well.
And given the comment of the person back here saying that usability, by definition, changes the technology involved, what you really need is some kind of feedback mechanism where people use it in a certain way to get an idea where it's been used and it evolves. And then, secondly, a lot of the stuff like the buttons here on the nav bar, that kind of stuff is, one could say, the functionality doesn't change. The functionality doesn't change.
Better desktop at all.
The position of it. And that can be adopted.
What I'm saying is, the user at the end of the day is the person who's going to use it.
Yep.
Now, in the simplest case, if the button is on the top bar or on the sidebar, the actual coding doesn't change. It's just an appearance. Whether it's a split window or whether it's a tab window, in essence, nothing's really changed in terms of coding. It's just the appearance and the usability of it. Now, that's what you want to capture. So
sure.
why don't you make it so that you actually get this information back from the people who are using it?
We do.
Make it so that they can actually, if they're a little bit more expert, they can drag and drop and put the button on a different place, and this gets fed back so you actually have some kind of statistics on where people prefer it to be. And then if someone's feeling a bit more adventurous, then they can go, okay, how are other people doing this? And they see a ghost button over here, they say, oh, okay, that's interesting, and they start using it. And if suddenly people start using it, it just becomes part of your project and you don't have to do all of this usability stuff.
That's a really bad idea.
You've got a couple of problems there. The first one is the huge, giant privacy issue that suddenly you've exposed.
Okay, do you want this to be public, yes or no?
There's still, and then now you've got security. So there's a lot of technical problems there. The solution that people have that is the best solution we had, none of the right people are here as far as I know. There's no one from the Novella Usability Lab here, is there? Yeah, my laptop can only play as my crash video because Daniel Stone hates me. That's certainly true.
Yep.
But
so it's true that maybe users don't know how to create usable software, but they do know what they do and don't like.
Yeah.
And you can have and you can have a beauty competition where people can pick whether it's going to be a green background or a red background or with all the other sophisticated button repositionings and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then basically based on people select a preference, use it, it becomes popular, and you know if you get that feedback.
The problem there.
The whole point about content management systems at the moment is that the people actually reading that content can contribute. So if you can make the user interface the same, then you're going to have the same kind of explosion of contribution.
But as an example, just a popularity concept in terms of how people use devices doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right way of doing things. I give an example of this as a thermostat. You know, you turn the dial on the thermostat to turn it up. If you get into a house and it's cold, and you want to
exactly
right. But everybody does that. It doesn't make the house any quicker. Keep it any quicker. But everyone does it anyway. So that defines the popularity of it. Now maybe if you do something to do that, if you whack it into the right, it does actually jet into the heat a bit quicker. But that's like where we've got what's happening all the time.
About the stuff that they actually get from you, just up to the more. long as they're used to where they're used. I've never changed the e-list scholarship anything on the online web page in my life, because as soon as I'm aware of this between stuff, I don't care.
Exactly. There's a few things here. Hang on, Pastor, I'll come to you in a sec. One of them is 90% of users couldn't care less as long as it's usable. The 10% of users are the ones who created Emacs, which is the only program I know that has not one but two separate eLisp IRC clients built into it, because one wasn't enough. Someone has to write one that worked differently. So you've got to watch out for that, which is why the only way to do reliable usability is to do usability labs. And if I felt like I could play video without crashing my laptop today, I would put up some of these stuff. Fun have done this in the past. Novell did it very recently. Novell basically drove a bus up to a company and said, we would like to use usability test our software. It was probably a little bit more complex than that. But so these people sat down at these SUSE Linux workstations running GNOME, and the way it works is you have a person sat there, and you're filming them, and you're recording all their interactions. And you ask the person to complete certain tasks, like, can you change the background? And they do it, and they record it. And it's quite a problem for some users, because they think they're being tested, and they think it makes them stupid. So you've got to make sure it's clear that you're testing the system, not them. But they carry out these operations, and they'll go through this whole checklist. Oh, can you change the background back again, please, to what it was? And things you want to know about. And from there, you watch them. And you can watch, particularly you've got video, of the users, of their face, and of the screen, and of them using the mouse. And so you can see when they go to do something, and they stop, and they pause, and you can see they're obviously thinking, and they bite their lip, and there's something obviously going on inside their head. And at that point, if you're seeing all of your users, so you get yourself a range of users, so you get the John O'Bacons, and you get the Glynns, and you get, like, my grandmother, and you sit them all down, and if they all suddenly go and bite their lip because they're having to think about something, then maybe there's something there you need to address. And under those conditions is the only real way they can get good, you can get good software design. Because otherwise you'll end up with one of two things. You'll end up with the problem you get with art, where everyone likes something different, or you'll end up with the thing that Kathy Sierra might talk about during her keynote, which is that with a bit of software that's perfect, like that works for everybody, is so conservative that it never will do anything ever again, and it will stagnate. Which is kind of, it happens to software projects all the time. You see, the project's trying to be everything for everyone, and as a result, it's nothing to no one, because everyone's gone and found something else. Pascal, you had something to add before?
I just wanted to point out just quite simply that apart from the whole privacy issue, that you can't really expect users to sort of give you feedback in a way other than something like this sort of lab. A, it's not going to be very, the amount of data you get back from this, I mean, you have a video camera watching their hand movements, watching things they do on the screen. You even have, like, cameras that actually monitor where the eye is on the screen, how it's moving and things like that. So it's kind of hard to sort of request user feedback, user interface feedback from just ordinary users about, you know, please fill out this form, that sort of thing. Especially considering that 70% of the users are Windows users, and then there's lots of things on Windows that are poorly designed, and they just live with it.
I was going to add one other thing. This comes from project management, which is a very interesting field to reach into. In project management, you've got a thing. When you ask your client to assess your product, you give them one of those standard forms. Please rate how we've done on task A through Z, like agree, strongly agree, neutral. And you have them complete these questionnaires, and your clients will do it. And your clients will start off and tick agree, 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 strongly agree. And your marketing people say, oh, we've got a rating of 90%. And so you'll find while you're doing good, you get these ratings. And your ratings will drop off. If you start performing badly, your ratings will drop off and vanish. But then after some time, and this is where it becomes relevant, is suddenly your rating will go back to 75%. And you go, whoa, obviously this client is completely happy with our software. 75% is a pretty, you know, if they're happy with 75% of the features in our software, we're doing quite well. But what you discover when you actually go to look into it is the client actually stopped running your software 7 months ago They're actually running your competitor's software. You've just been sending out these surveys, assuming they're still running your software. And some guy, Phil Soper, has ticked agree in every single box. So look what's happened there. If you ask the users who actually, you know, you're going to have the users who are happy with it and just going to go, oh, yeah, agree. And you have some users who are actually unhappy with it, who actually will strongly disagree. We have a lot of people who are really apathetic and just go, yeah. And the results that you come out when you do your own product testing that way will be extremely skewed to the apathetic people. Because even if you go and get your sample group, all those apathetic people are like, oh, yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I like that. Anything, like any comments, anything you prove? No. So you do run into that quite a lot.
Just as a kind of alternative view to usability, Ion has a kind of different approach. Their website is a bit... anyway, what they say is usability does not equal low learning curve. So it's mostly a keyboard-based thing, but they're designed for ease of use after you've already got to know the system. So it's not see it and it's immediately obvious. You have a look at it, work out how you can best make use of its features, such as keyboard binding for various different tasks.
Yeah, sure.
To make things a lot easier. So when you actually know your system inside out, it should be, even if you start from kind of, you see it and you know what it does, it should be kind of scalable, I guess, to the people who want to, you know, do things faster and with less trouble.
And affordability. The term you're looking for, Jono, is affordability. How affordable? It's confusing. How affordable is my object? The idea is that I'm trying to think of something. Door handle, like, is relatively affordable. In your standard door up here, it obviously opens on one side, the door's on the other, the handle turns, you push. There aren't really any other, the only other option is push without turning the handle, or turn the handle and do nothing. So the design of the object is fairly affordable, you see what it does. Compared to a lot of software, so even the software might be highly usable to the guy who knows his way all the way around it. You see this in accounting software all the time. If you know all 800 shortcuts, you can drive it like mad. You see it a bit in Inkscape as well. If you know all the shortcuts, you can do anything you want. But if you've never, ever come into it, the UI is not, like, the interface is not necessarily affordable because you don't quite see what to do first. So usability covers more than just, is it easy to use? They're right.
Yeah.
And people get confused. They think usability and they go, oh, that means it's really easy for stupid people to use. But affordability is, I'm inexperienced, how do I... like, how do I figure it out? So you pick up a pen, you can only put two ends down on the paper, one of them writes. You've got a fairly affordable object. But you pick up, you know, you get into an aircraft and you sit down and you're surrounded on all sides by controls. You've never sat, well, assuming you're not a pilot, you've never sat in an aircraft before. How do you put it in the sky? Someone has a hand up.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues with, like, Ion, like, I use Ion, and I like it, but I think one of the big target audiences of GNOME is that not everyone has the time to sit down and crack out all the time to learn every nook and cranny of how something works. It's, I don't know how many, like, my mom's not going to have enough time to sit at the computer to, this is how you need to do this, this, and this, and shortcuts. It just needs to need to work, and you need to do it now.
So. For people who are actually like using their system every day and who need or who like at least smart ways to like optimize their workflow.
At work though, I don't get paid to sit and customize everything. I get paid to work. And so if I have to
customize it.
So you've got a couple of things there. One is the thing I came back to before, which is know who you're designing for. We've got 40 geophysicists who use GNOME every single day of their lives. I know for a fact that if you gave them Ion, they'd just stare at it and rub their heads. They're not the kind of people who need to customize their window manager because they have two large screens, they filled it with windows, and everything they need to look at is right in front of them. And to be honest, Ion would do an excellent job at that, but they wouldn't be able to deal with it.
they're more than happy with what they've got, because then when they want to drag a window around, they just pick it up and drag it around. It's affordable to them. But to people, I used to use PWM, which the Ion guy wrote before he wrote Ion. And back when I used to use PWM, I actually really liked it because of what you could do, and you could drive it all with a keyboard, and I was like, this is excellent. For what it's worth, you can drive Vitacity fairly well with a keyboard. And it amazes me no end that you get these geophysicists and they've discovered all these features. You never told them they existed. They discovered them anyway. And I feel that if you gave them something like Ion or PWM or MWM or however many other things people run, because window managers are like text editors. Everyone, well, maybe not in here, but you walk on this conference, you'll see every window manager currently shipping, except maybe for TWM, because I think Keith Packard switched. So you run into that, so you know who you're designing for. If you're designing for someone who wants to make sure all their code is on the screen and their documentation, they want to use mad keystrokes to switch between it because they don't have a mouse or because their fingers are permanently welded to the home keys, design for that, sure. You can still be usable and you can still be affordable within that design frame, but you're designing for a different group of people to how you're designing Metacity. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it would be possible to, I don't know, one great thing about the whole open source thing is that there's always a plethora of things to choose from. So there's always, whatever your problem is, there's a solution for it or something that's close enough to a solution that you can either hack it or just live with it.
Sure.
So it's important that there be a lot of things to choose from. I mean, I don't want to, you know, force my text editor on everybody because everybody likes different things. But what am I trying to say here?
Yeah.
As a general comment on GNOME usability, and I guess I don't know how much longer you guys want to end up being discussing GNOME usability or usability in general, I think it's very simple to say that there is so much choice, especially in the open source community, but if we don't want to be one of those bizarre sort of strange in terms of out of all the choices available, window managers or desktop environments that only the true geeks and hackers ever use. If we want to ever reach something like 10x10, I think the best path and the path we're sort of on is to follow the recommendations and the things we learn from projects like betterdesktop.org, because that gives us an idea exactly what the sort of average common day sort of person would be using and what they would be doing. And then we just continue having the same sort of options and configurability that allowed me to put my GNOME desktop the way I like it, as opposed to how most common distributions ship it. So currently I don't see much of a problem with GNOME usability. I just see we shouldn't be jumping off and trying to accommodate for Ion users so they can go back to GNOME, or accommodate for KDE users so they can switch from KDE to GNOME. I think that GNOME already has a lot of customizable sort of functionality. It's just a matter of let's stick with the sort of ordinary chaps, people who are going to be working in an office, who we want them to use GNOME, and then continue offering the configurability that I use and to make my desktop look not like the common one. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to talk, Callum?
Yeah. So for the last 20 minutes, something's been bugging me in the back of my head, and I just figured out what it is. The conversation has been, this isn't meant to be personal, but we have to make sure that GNOME is, Well, that's actually missing a really important point. This is the GNOME love session, right? And even if it wasn't, when we started this morning, almost everyone in the room said, I'm a GNOME user. And so I just wanted to make the observation that at the end of the day, GNOME and every other piece of open source software out there is what people write. And the amazing thing about the open source movement is that no one can tell you no. You can get the source code, you can change anything you want, and you can do anything you want. But the most important thing is don't be scared off by this usability discussion. Yes, there are things to learn from, but the best part is that if you've got a great idea and you think you can do something better, go for it. If there's something about an application that pisses you off, like the side of the menu, go for it. Get a patch in, great. If it's a case of documentation, a bug, something is bothering you, go ahead and write it. And although I just said that no one can tell you no, you will get a lot of flack sometimes. And that's one of the less appealing things about the open source movement. But that is the enlightenment and the enabling factor of the age of information, is that everyone has a voice. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody can use it credibly. So if you've got a great idea, an initiative you want to pursue, all I can say to you, and you know, this is honest coming from the perspective of somebody who's doing something sort of in a damn the torpedoes way anyway, so I'm, you know, smack in the middle of this myself, just give it a try. You know, the reason there's hundreds of thousands of projects out there is because many of them didn't work out. They didn't bring the critical mass they needed, and that's fine. That's competition in action, Darwinism in action. But you know what? Maybe your idea will change the world. And I'd far rather that you give it a try and make something special than for you to not try it and the world not be a better place as a result. And you know what? People with usability experience can join your project and help you out too. And ask for help. So try and keep an open mind on the one hand, and you know, listen to what people say. But when you get like the old grumpy, you know, it used to be the Unix guys with the beards and the sandals and suspenders, snap. And well, GNOME's been around long enough now that there are suspender snappers. Okay? So, and they like writing email. Lots of it. So if you were just to go by the discussions on desktop devel list at GNOME.org, you would think that GNOME is a place where no innovation happens. But you know what? Something like Jacocher behind us wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for somebody that stood up and was innovative. Right? Because I could, you know, easily get a conversation thread going with all reasons why you shouldn't do meh. And so, you know, take people's feedback and then just go on with it. And here's a little tiny secret.
It made me very unpopular.
GNOME actually doesn't matter. What matters is you license software and then a distro ships it. GNOME is a meeting ground in the middle. And one of the things that we've been talking about at the other GNOME conferences is, you know, what is GNOME? And that's actually a really big open-ended question. This afternoon when Jeff was talking, you know, there was sort of a casual mention of, you know, get that GNOME foot logo on the side of a piece of hardware. I'm actually not interested in that in terms of GNOME inside, although that's awesome to see. But what I am really, I think, and this is an idea that some of the people on the GNOME board have had, the one name that comes to mind is Dave Neary, but many have had this notion, which is that maybe GNOME is a certification mark. Right? Maybe GNOME is a standard of quality in both in our release processes and usability and in accessibility and translations and internationalization. And maybe it means all those things. And what it actually looks like on the screen, well, whatever. And some apps meet that standard and are in GNOME, and some don't. But the funny thing is that some actually do an end run around that and end up in the distros anyway. The reason to aspire to being in GNOME is because then you are able to tap into the pool of translations and internationalization, and that's, you know, talk about use cases and usability, when you've got people with languages that go the other direction, things like that, it gets pretty complicated. So, you know, there's a lot of ideas there, but I'm actually really, you know, here's a really radical idea. You know, if GNOME is the first certification mark and our software stack is portable, then there will be a day in the not-too-distant future when you can run GNOME on Windows.
Excellent.
Now, that's what you wanted to mention at a Linux conference. And I'm actually, you know, that doesn't make me comfortable, but I'm willing to try and open my mind to the idea that, you know what, if our software stack reaches a quality standard and we can present that, then suddenly, you know, the whole point was to commoditize the operating system. Yeah, I think Linux is better, but really we want to bring the ideas of open information and users making choices and users helping themselves to a wider world.
You know, out of interest, Andrew, have you seen Evolution on Windows?
It's a relatively new thing.
It does run now.
Yeah. Brutus or something, he called it? Codewood?
No, that's something else.
Oh, okay.
They actually directly ported Evolution to Windows. Because they want to have it. It's a better groupware client than for actual Novell. Like, it's a better groupware client for Novell groupware than the stuff that already ships on Windows, so might as well do that one. Yes, but no. There are interesting caveats. There are things like swapping all your button orders.
So I mentioned that just as a way out there idea.
Yeah.
I actually am fairly active in my support of the cause of, you know what, I don't care if my software runs on Windows. You know, I'm writing software for the GNOME desktop to run on Linux and Solaris and select other operating systems, and I could give a flying beep about, you know, the commercial proprietary operating system that's trying actively to take us down. So, you know what, I'm happy to actually be kind of restrictive. But I also accept that there are other people that are working in that direction and have interest that way. And, you know, that's what I said before, open source happens where the overlap is. You know, we don't have to agree, but if there's some commonality between us, then, you know, there's room for collaboration, and that's where we can share.
Okay. Yep, we've got one at the back. We might make this, you want to let them down? Might make this the last point, because at some point I could do with a drink.
Beer.
Project is converting from Canvas to GDK.
Yep.
And found it a totally and utterly frustrating experience.
Porting to Canvas. Sorry.
Porting our environment across.
From one canvas to another.
From one presentation to another. I'll use that expression. Total rewrite. GNOME thinks it knows better about how to lay out desktops. It goes madly astray. It is a very frustrating platform to use. It is very frustrating to try and get answers back from the community. Everyone seems to be locked into various commercial interests and unable to be available. I'm just making a comment that if GNOME wants to succeed, they've got to succeed by getting commercial applications or business applications operating using it.
Okay, you're
right. Frustrations that we've experienced are no different to anybody else. We're running over 600 business applications, and it has been a nightmare that we haven't finished yet.
Okay, I understand. I certainly understand that, and I sympathise with all those points. We can chat about this later on if you like. That way, you can perhaps chat a little more in depth. You've got a problem where you've got a community, and you commonly find people go to the communities of things, but perhaps the community, specifically for GNOME, is very large. And you go sometimes to people, and because these people, like, they may not know, they may not be being paid to do it, so they may not have any time. Particularly, I know there's people who can't be here because their children are being born. And then you've also got people who are being paid to work on GTK, but they've got to complete their deadlines. And I think I spend my day writing GTK code, and then I come home like in the evening, and I have every intention to get back to doing my personal project. I just crash because
I'm not disputing that. We're offering to pay. That's not the issue. We just found it very hard to get people in the community to actually commit.
There's certainly companies you can deal with. Like I said, we'll discuss them more in depth later. I can give you some companies. They're unfortunately, as far as I know, aren't in Australia. There's certainly two I can think of in Europe. There's at least one I can think of in the US who are free for private consultation and contracting. So it is true, with Unity Growth, we do need to produce vertical apps. The GTK was put together with the premise of building proprietary vertical apps on top of a free stack. Because you're right, people won't end up using the software if they can't move their applications to it. I'm disappointed you found it hard, but you won't have been you're not the only person. I know that for a fact.
I'm not the only person, but I'm just commenting. Everyone's patting themselves on the back with this good product, and it is not a good product for someone to want to come in and say, here is a platform I want to build on top of, and I need to massage this because I need certain screen layouts, I need to achieve, I've got to convert people that are used to certain screen and certain interfaces, I've got to get that usability that we spoke about into my new application, new presentation.
Okay, so that's a secondary point, and that's interesting as well, which is if you're choosing to go to GNOME as a platform, then whether you agree with the interface guidelines or not, because there's people who don't, and even some of them, I treat them as guidelines, I don't treat them as gospel, but there are people who do treat them as gospel, I think to their own detriment. GTK is one thing, GTK should force you to make GTK shouldn't force any of its, anyone's ideals upon you. But if you end up buying into GNOME as a whole and you're going to take the whole desktop experience, then they've made decisions that, whether you agree with them or not, people who are good at this kind of thing have decided it's the right course. And for consistency is what we're doing. You see the same thing. Apple have an set of interface guidelines. And whether you agree with them or not, it's what they decide to do. And by and large, their applications are fairly consistent. Even from third-party developers, the application is consistent. They feel like they belong on the Apple desktop. You throw over to Windows, where they have none of this. It's only beginning to come in now. And every application behaves completely differently. And you have applications with different standardized layouts and different ways to present information to the user. And yes, it means the developer has free rein. They can present information any way they want. But really, you could do that without having to buy into the philosophy. Your application may look a bit out of place, but if you think you've got a better way to do that, and you think, you know, if you think you can build a better thing, then by all means, because that's what it's about.
Yes, but it is not a manageable desktop.
You don't think so?
No. What do you mean by manageable? I've got to get 60 questions across the desktop, or 70 questions across the desktop, and I need to lay that out in a manageable way. And then decide to spread it off the desktop and do all sorts of things. I've got an application where I'm quite happy with the layout I want on the screen to get the information interface. And it says, no, this is usability, and it will take this line that's got no padding in it, and put a pile of padding onto the line and take it and spread it.
So, you're having trouble kind of
packages and layout, just getting screen management to work.
I think we should wrap this up. If you like, we can chat about this just right now, if you like, but we'll get off the air and let people go to the pub.
I'm just raising an issue.
Yeah, sure. It's fine. And I'd love to chat about it. So, well, we'll wrap up for today. I think you turn this off that way. Tomorrow, there's the keynote. I think it's Blizzard. And Blizzard's a bit of a dude. Then John A. Bacon's talking. You're talking at some point. So Andrew Cowell is talking about re-architecting Java GNOME. We're probably going to have some lightning talks because we need to add some more stuff in, so it's not very long. David Zusin's talking. And Pete Ryland. So I hope today wasn't too dull. And I hope we see some of you again tomorrow. Okay, thank you very much.